Happy Monday and welcome to the Reason Podcast. That sounded very aggressive, doesn't it? Happy Monday.
Be happy.
Happy Monday and welcome to the Reason Podcast, the weekly chat show version here on Monday. I am Matt Welch, joined in our deluxe Park Slope studio by the purple-haired vixen of freedom, Catherine Mangu Ward, who's now the newly crowned editor of every single thing that exists at Reason.
All the things.
All the things, editor. And in the DC Bureau, unless I am gravely mistaken, our common alcoholic Peter Suderman and our millennial correspondent, Robbie Suave. Robbie, are the headphones...
That's fancy booze connoisseur Peter Suderman to you?
I mean, listen, everyone has their own reality. I think what was something that we've learned here and is important, you know, there's no one true way. Read the future and its enemies for once, Peter. Robbie, just a quick, your headphones and the hair, are you okay? I mean, it's going to be all right?
Yeah, I crashed my hair into the microphone stand, but I've got a spare hairspray on my person at all times, so we're good. Let's get the show on the road. We're good.
So we're going to talk about a lot of stuff today, including National School Choice Week, which begins today. Of which Reason is a co-sponsor. Is that right? We're a co-sponsor, right? The Women's March 2.0, hopefully. The generational rift within the Me Too movement, if such a thing exists. And, of course, the government shutdown. But before all that, just a reminder out there in listener land, subscribe to us already over at iTunes, rate/review us, and et cetera. Thank you very much for your patronage. Let's start with a shutdown. Peter, since you are now like writing about the stuff for the New York Times all the time, like a fancy common alcoholic, and also since we're recording this at 11 o'clock, just in front of a scheduled, I believe, noon vote out there, and this will be released, you know, in mid-afternoon as it usually is, tell us confidently in a way that won't embarrass you later what exactly is going to happen at 12, which will have already happened by the time people listen to this.
What's going to happen at 12 is that there's going to be a vote, and as of this morning, no one knows how it's going to go. There was initially going to be a vote at 1 a.m. last night, but then they postponed it to this afternoon, and that vote would keep the government open until, I believe, February 8th, on the promise that work would continue in some vague way on dealing with immigration, dealing with border security, which, of course, is always tied up with immigration, dealing with military funding, all of these priorities that have been hooked to the keeping the government open. And that if no deals had been reached by that deadline, Mitch McConnell said in a statement last night something like, at that point, it would be my intention to proceed with a vote on immigration, on an immigration bill. Now, what the hell does that mean? At that point, it would be my intention. That is like the most incredibly hedged legislation from a guy who, or excuse me, a hedged statement from a guy who is, let's face it, not exactly the most reliable predictor of his own behavior, especially when it comes to immigration. And, you know, so one point about this is, on the one hand, Democrats have, you know, if you sort of want to break down this issue, because that's all we have done this weekend is play the blame game. If you want to break it down, on the one hand, Democrats have tried to attach a completely unrelated issue to keeping the government open. And that's the deferred action for childhood immigrants, the DACA program and the Dreamers, who lost some of whom have already lost protection because Donald Trump ended the Obama era program in last September. It's totally unrelated. On the other hand, Republicans keep saying they want to do it and keep not doing it. And it's the public is on Democrat side. Democrats are, of course, on Democrat side. And Democrats are trying to find some way to force the issue, because it really looks like Republicans just don't want to give the Dreamers any kind of legal status at all.
Catherine, I sometimes worry that all of us, meaning now you, because you're in charge of everything in the Reason editorial universe, that we've flirting too much with becoming process libertarians. On this podcast, we have spent time complaining that Congress is not following the Congressional Budget Review Act of 1974 and submitting its 12 appropriations bills and all this kind of stuff. And heading into this totally not totally, but mostly kind of pointless and stupid shutdown. We were heaping derision on the congenital inability of Congress to do its basic legislative job. Are we missing an opportunity to stand back here and just point and laugh and giggle like teenage boys with zits?
I think we're probably missing an opportunity to heap derision on Congress for the way it does its job as well as the way it doesn't do its job. And we should probably heap more derision. I don't think that derision is a zero-sum game. It's important to think of how we can expand the derision pie. And so in this case, I think it is good to be both process libertarians and content libertarians. It is a bunch of fucking bullshit that we spend all this fucking money on so much fucking stuff. There's your content libertarianism. And, you know, hurrah shutdowns, in which we once again remind the American public that there are, whatever it is, 800,000 non-essential federal workers who are not essential because they're not essential.
Robbie, you're a millennial. And more importantly, you are, if I'm not mistaken, and sorry for endangering your marriage, you're married to the federal government, are you not? Can you tell us either something that will cause a divorce, get your wife fired, or otherwise, broader picture, tell us what the avocado toast eating millennials who work for the federal government are all doing right now besides drinking Peter Sudeman's cocktails.
Wow, that's a lot to accomplish. That's a tall order. Yes, so for reasons of deeply personal reasons of making my marriage work, and also for ideological reasons, I don't rejoice when the government shuts down because my wife gets furloughed and that's annoying, but also because... I mean, it's not like the aspects of the government that we most want to not exist really do stop functioning when the government shuts down, right? The TSA is still stopping people. ICE is still deporting people. Nothing about the massive entitlement state is actually really halted. So all that happens is a bunch of federal workers. Now, obviously, there should be less of them. Some of what they do is not essential. You know, we would change the structure of the government to reflect this. But they don't get to go to work. They get confused. Some of them do live paycheck to paycheck. It's not good for the economy. So I'm not a libertarian who thinks we need to be all like, yes, this is great. The government is shutting down. This is actually solving our problems, which is something Jeffrey Miron said too at of Cato in a Vox article a couple days ago. I thought the article was only flawed in that he really didn't think he was saying libertarians shouldn't cheer this kind of thing. He didn't really point out any that were doing that, although I'm sure there were, and maybe you guys were doing that. But anyway, that's my take on it. And I don't think young people are going to think better of libertarians if we're kind of, you know, it's fine to joke about the government shutting down, but seriously being like, this is a good way to bring about libertarianism, I don't think it makes us look good.
I mean, the panda cam got turned off. And like I said on Twitter, I know anarchists who believe that the panda cam at the National Zoo is an essential government
function. Yeah, you're never going to score points by being in favor of the panda cam shutting down. Even I'm lost at that point to libertarianism. Sorry.
Well, there is one group of libertarians who I think have good reason to be celebrating this, and these are the capital L friends among our libertarians. They're organizing a political party around competition with the two main parties. And one of the things about shutdowns is that they're always unpopular. They never make anyone more popular. You know, there's an argument to be had that the 2013 Ted Cruz, Mark Meadows shutdown was not as unpopular as we think because Republicans won a bunch of elections in the midterms in 2014. I would argue and probably have in this setup that damaged a whole lot of things that Republicans would ever want to do again in terms of negotiating other fiscal conservative items. But as polled in real time, government shutdowns are never popular. And we have something that's that I think is completely dissimilar to 2013. 2013 was a breath-holding exercise. How long is it going to take before Ted Cruz finally turns purple enough that he's going to have to exhale and this will all be over? Because Obama was never going to suddenly cancel Obamacare. That just wasn't on the table. This time, both parties have a perfectly plausible thing to tell their base. Donald Trump says, these damn Democrats care about illegals more than they do about funding our great military and the border. Boom. It totally resonates. Schumer shutdown, hashtag. Democrats have these damn heartless Republicans want to sacrifice, child immigrants, blameless immigrants, and also children for their health insurance rather than pass a normal budget. They control all of government. Hashtag Trump shutdown. The end. So I think that says to me we're going to be in here for a while because they can tell us all of these things. And even though I started this thing by pointing at Catherine, I'm going to shift over to – no, I'm going to keep it with Catherine actually because besides DACA, which we talked about here a lot, the Children's Health Insurance Program, CHIP, has been bandied about in all of this. And the basic claim is that Republicans got rid of this or failed to reauthorize this back in the fall. And they're using that in a very cynical way, holding it hostage in these negotiations. And there's the bedrock assumption that you see widespread in the press that CHIP is an unalloyed great thing that should just be reauthorized forever and ever. Since you, Catherine, are a heartless libertarian, is that true?
It's not true, of course, that it's an unalloyed great thing, just as it is not true that all of the big dumb entitlements where we, in an inefficient manner, provide health insurance to some subset of the population are not necessarily a great thing. But this is mostly just a case of dumb demagoguery, right? This is clearly a moment where they looked around for some piece of unfinished business and picked the one that sounded the worst, right? Like Congress, the floor of Congress is littered with unfinished business. They could have picked any bill, any legislation, any program that is currently being authorized in some kind of half-assed continuing resolution. We'll get to that later. We promise, Mom, way. And then said, this is the thing the Republicans don't want to renew. Health insurance for children sounds like the best possible thing to plug that hole.
You're Democrats, kind of going Stossel there.
Democrats almost didn't a pick this. Exactly.
I'll go full Stossel on this. Couldn't it be that maybe the private sector could provide insurance for children?
Healthcare person, what you were talking?
Yeah, so, I mean, it wasn't simply that Democrats picked this. It was that Republicans didn't pursue reauthorization after it expired at the end of September. And then after saying, well, of course, we want to reauthorize this. And that's just sort of pro forma thing we're definitely going to do. They tried to say, hey, Democrats, this is what we'll give you as part of the budget deal, since we don't want to do immigration. And so this was in that the tying CHIP to this was heavily a Republican idea. Now, it's funny that you should bring up the private sector and providing health coverage for children, because one of the big issues with CHIP, if you go back to the 2007 reauthorization fight, if you look at the Congressional Budget Office reports, which I really highly recommend, they're extremely exciting. One of the things you will find is that, in fact, the numbers of people of children covered under CHIP, like what we like, it covers about 9 million children. And so people think, well, if we didn't have CHIP, that would be 9 million kids without health insurance. No, in fact, something like a quarter and maybe as many as much as like 40% of that is just shifting from private coverage to CHIP, which is a kind of a sister program to Medicaid. So it is not simply a one-to-one trade here. And in fact, the existence of CHIP, and this is one of the big criticisms of it, the existence of CHIP displaces private health insurance for children.
I'm just I'm trying to process all this fantastical information. Wasn't CHIP also it's Hillary Clinton's like her one legislative achievement, right, Suderman?
Well, I mean, it was originally passed in 1997 under Bill Clinton.
Right, but like she as a first lady, that was in the fallout, Clinton Care, whatever. What do we call it?
Hillary Care. Hillary Care. Yeah. She's a lady, so we use her first name.
Yeah.
Well, it's because Hillary we had Care. To distinguish between Hillary and Bill. There were multiple Clintons in the world at that time. There are still multiple
the way
Clintons.
That Hillary Clinton's name is being used?
Uh-huh, he did. That was just
awesome.
Full-fledged mansplain. No, but this is, I mean, the whole thing does have like a really amazing kind of vintage sexist feel to it, right? Like, okay, we had Hillary Care because maybe America will be okay with a first lady doing healthcare, and then America was like, oh no, we don't let the first ladies or maybe any ladies do big policy. And they were like, okay, what if it's just for kids, because ladies can do kid stuff, right? And then it was like, okay, I guess we'll do that, as like as a deal.
And she was back then, too. I don't recommend, unlike Peter recommending CBO reports, I don't recommend going back and Google image searching all the times that Hillary Clinton had cartoon characters on the White House lawn to talk about children's media, because she was going to be our czar for making sure that the children didn't see the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers more than they should.
Wasn't that more of a Tipper jam?
She took, if you would read the stories that I publish in your magazine.
I remember that one with the shouty Hillary on the cover.
She took the baton from Tipper. Tipper had the first impulse, and then Hillary like ran with it. And they proceeded from there to do a bunch of stuff for children.
And that's why the government is shut down today. Right?
It's Hillary's
basically
fault.
It's a direct line.
Oh my God.
This is our...
You guys, the shutdown is Hillary's fault.
Robbie, you're still on your parents' health care. when you are hanging around, I presume that you spend all your time in Adams Morgan doing things. Do young people still go to Washington out of a sense of idealism? Because like watching this, regardless of where you stand on it, or even if you're in the corner cheering the how this is all going to help the Libertarian Party in the future, just because they aren't the one of them in power now doing the terrible things. But like if you watch C-SPAN for even 45 minutes, you just want to start guzzling Drano. It is so awful, and it's so transparently bad faith. And, you can tell because they keep saying talking about good faith negotiations. So the kids these days, they tend to be idealistic in general, but the ones who are swarming the avocado toast bars in Adams Morgan, is there a sense of idealism out there anymore? Has it been burned off?
No, I think there is still a powerful sense of idealism, but it has been it's not channeled as much through government. There is this kind of disenchantment with government going on, partly because Trump is in charge of it, and to millennials, to Gen Z, to young people, Trump is the most horrifying and embarrassing. And how could this person be in charge of the government? What does that say about government service if it's being run by this man? But that I don't think that makes them necessarily less invested in kind of liberal feel-goodery kind of idealism. But, I've been talking to sort of activist type people for this book I'm writing on college campuses. And so many of them said to me they still want to, they want to bring about social change. But they were not saying to me, oh, I want to join the Peace Corps, or oh, I want to run for office. So many of them were saying, no, I just want to get a normal job in business, and I will infect corporate culture with my sort of social justice activism and change the world that way, which is kind of maybe more frightening and more insidious if you think about it. But no, they're not super. Yeah, I gotta go help get somebody elected. Trump disabused them of that, I think.
The thing that I actually like about that version, though, is the idealism will mutate when it comes in contact with reality if it's taken into the private sector, right? If you're an idealist and you come to Washington, you just become a cynical idealist who still thinks the underlying ideals are good. If you're an idealist who goes into the corporate side of things, I think you're more likely to say, like, okay, well, let me prioritize it against other things. Let me think about how I can do good within the framework of also doing something else. And I think that's kind of what the Me Too movement is in some ways, right? It's the way that people in the private sector do, a readjusting of how gender relations are working, say. And it's much less unmoored from reality. I actually think like the millennials taking their do-goodery to the private sector sounds pretty good to me.
Well, let's talk about the Me Too and the millennial aspect to that. Robbie, one of the things that I was noticing Fur posted last week is that behind a lot of the stories, most of the headline attention-grabbing one last week was the fight between the Babe.net editor, writer Katie Way, I believe her name is, and Ashley Banfield of Headline News. I'm sorry. It's just very funny how the Katie Way's email, she's like 22 or 23, 22.
It's actually unclear in the email, which is interesting. There's one place in the email where she says she's 22 and another one where she says she's 23, which like, shouldn't she be sure?
It's millennials. So,
you old wouldn't get it, not knowing your age
is a social
like
construct,
super
Catherine.
Yeah. Sorry. Good point. Olds.
But I
that's the real so divide.
That was, That was
people who know their age and people who don't.
That was a headline grabbing thing there, Robbie. But in a lot of these stories about discussions and tensions that are happening in media workplaces, there's a huge generational thing there everywhere. The treatment of Glenn Thrush over at the New York Times, who was, depending on your point of view, awkward, grabby, kissy, drunky, and lie-y about his attempts to be romantic with people, or was, you know, he should be fired and acting in bad faith. The reported divisions in the newsroom were totally generational. It was a kind of millennials, or even what did you call the next one, Robbie?
The next people are Gen Z.
But there's also the Zennials.
The Zennials. Well, that's the terrible word that you're trying to concoct. But in your – so you talk about the people trying to go and affect their workplaces there. And since you write also a lot about sexual assault policy and gender politics on campus, can you paint us a picture – of sort of generational attitudes that and divisions, if they are such, or if they're just being cynically promoted by the likes of Meghan McArdle out there off to get hate clicks and Me Too in the Me Too movement?
Well, of course, there are, you know, generational traitors probably on both sides, but I think broadly that trend that you just kind of laid out is true. I mean, the Aziz Ansari piece kind of makes that really clear, right? I mean, babe.net, this very sort of millennial, feminist, younger than that even, kind of blogging place, you know, she told this story, the Aziz Ansari accuser told this story to them, in which it is framed, or it is allowed to be presented as a sexual assault. She says, the woman giving the confession says it's sexual assault. And yet, almost no one kind of older than that who wrote about it, even if they thought Aziz behaved badly, was willing to call it sexual assault. I wouldn't call it sexual assault. And I was on Michael Smirkanish's radio show last week to talk about this, and he did a poll of his audience or something where like 95% of people said it was not sexual assault. But babe.net presented it as sexual assault. So I think that does point to this this changing understanding of how of what is consent, how much consent do you need. You know, if I just feel uncomfortable about it, but I didn't say no, we're not going to do this, could I still say that I was assaulted? And you have younger feminist, often activist type people saying yes, absolutely, and older people saying no. The problem with this on college campuses particularly is that there's this, you know, massive bureaucracy to adjudicate sexual harassment and sexual assault in violation, in my opinion, of principles of due process that is forced on campus because of the dictates of the education department. They're required to make colleges do this according to the federal law called Title IX. So you have these campus bureaucracies, investigating things exactly like the Aziz Ansari dispute. I mean, exactly like it. I've seen kids expelled, their lives ruined for doing things that are much less bad than what Aziz Ansari is accused of doing. And if what is
just a factual follow up. But that's over, right? Betsy DeVos killed that with her laser sword.
Right. Betsy DeVos did something that I think was very smart and very right by recalling the letter that said colleges have to do it this way. However, she didn't say colleges can't do it this way because this violates kind of the due process protections. So many colleges who hired people to do it the Obama administration way, where we're going to have a preponderance of the evidence standard and we're going to use single investigators and we're not going to explicitly require lawyers and we're going to not allow the students to actually cross-examine each other and so on and so forth, all these kinds of policies that I think make you more likely to violate the rights of an accused student. She didn't say you can't do any of this. She just said it's no longer required. So what kind of effect will this have? I mean, realistically, we don't know. But it could be that all these colleges who hired these people to do this kind of just leave them in place. Now, maybe some institutions will go a different way. Maybe Harvard, with its kind of really strong commitment to liberal principles, its law school kind of made a heroic stand against this interpretation of Title IX. They might change course, have a more equitable proceedings, but I don't know that the reality is actually going to change just because of this, the Betsy DeVos decision at so many colleges.
Catherine, I made the claim in my post of last week that women who are in straddling in between.
Nope.
Sorry. Rephrase. Women of a certain age.
Nope.
Yeah. It's so much harder in person.
Yeah.
Here.
You see my little face looking at you. You're like,
judging,
I am just an offensive.
I'm looking
man
out the
person.
Window. At
Go ahead. Try again.
Playing.
You can do it.
I think that we have an opportunity here just to have a war between women in their mid-30s and women in their early 20s.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Over questions of agency, primarily.
Yes, that war is coming. That war may be here, thanks to Aziz Ansari. So thanks, buddy, for that gift to female kind. So I actually last night went to my alma mater and spoke with some students there. And this came up. And I said, you know, I think it's been interesting to see people maybe find the limits of the Me Too movement in this Aziz Ansari thing. I basically, you know, pointed to this divide that Robbie described between how older people are reacting to this story, which is like, oh, okay, well, this is we found the edge of like where we're going to freak out about sort of private sexual behavior. And this is it. This was a little too far. We can back up. And looked around the room and it was like a bunch of dead eye stares. Like people were like, no, we did not find the limits. We are still going on.
Was
the
it
limits.
Worse than Gillespie's Depends joke at the Jacobin debate?
Nothing is worse than that. But in fact, like there was, you know, the sort of way I got the audience back, such as it was by saying, you know, my initial reaction to the whole Me Too movement was to say like, wow, this is really interesting because none of this has ever happened to me. Like I sort of didn't feel the initial impulse to like hashtag Me Too. And then there's been this kind of experience of like recovered memories, like a la the like satanic daycare panic of the 80s, but real, I think, of, you know, oh, but what about this guy that we both know and that thing that you saw? Oh, yeah, no, that was really bad. Oh, what about this thing? Oh, no, that one was bad, too. And there's this sort of recalibrating of my past experience. And I think a lot of women in their 30s, at least, are doing that, that we sort of brushed stuff off and were proud of having done so. And all the women in their 20s are like, thanks a lot, bitches. Now we have to do the work. Like, thanks for all the brushing off. But think again.
Suderman, you have the same birthday as Catherine Mengu Ward. Did you hope that the year 2018, you'd spend a lot of time talking about gradations of sexual consent with your work colleagues?
I have been excited about that for a very long time. You know, this is we're moving closer to my 10th anniversary at Reason, and I've really been just waiting for this moment to happen. I think the thing that we are not doing enough of here, and you will appreciate this, Matt Welch, after my CBO comments, the thing that we are not doing enough here is applying economic thinking to the sexual marketplace. Because
drudge siren.
Way to live your own stereotype and the stereotype of your ideological brethren. Here's the thing about the Me Too movement: needs more economic thinking. You're, by the way, not wrong, but go ahead. Just
go ahead,
embrace
yes.
the stereotype.
So there's a great piece in New York Magazine by Park McDougald, kind of reviewing, arguing with, but also in some ways agreeing with a book by Mark Regnerus titled Cheap Sex. This book came out last year. And basically the argument of the book is that the long tail of the sexual revolution has reduced the price of sex. So when he says that that sex is cheap, he's not making a sort of a kind of conventional moral argument like, oh, life's cheap, sex. No, what he's saying is that it doesn't have the same sort of cost associated with it that it did 50 or 100 years ago, and that as a result, what has ended up happening is that this has empowered a kind of male sense of sexual license, and also left women with no language to think about sex outside of consent. And so anything that isn't sort of a super enthusiastic consensual experience, like, for example, Aziz Ansari's date with the woman who talked to Babe, anything outside of that then has to become sexual assault. And I mean, there's actually some pretty interesting research on this. I think this is particularly concentrated amongst on college campuses, and where a lot of our sort of sexual practice acceptability debates are located and start on college campuses. And what has happened on college campuses over the last few decades? We have shifted from a majority male environment to a majority female environment. And when you see there's pretty good sociological research that shows that when men are in the minority in a sort of a dating pool, women and women are in the majority, then what happens is that male preferences for sort of quick hookups and that are not highly committed end up ruling because there are fewer men, and so they are sort of a hotter commodity just in an economic sense. And so there's a kind of an economic component here. And of course, there are all sorts of weird moral judgments embedded in all of this, and you have to try and disentangle or at least avoid, or maybe you should think head on about, well, are these sort of male and female preferences, do we really think that they are sort of deeply embedded in our genetics, in our culture, or what is the cause of them? And I don't want to take, like, that's not what this is about at all. You know, sort of the Regnerist point was basically just that in more cases than not, women tend to be the sexual gatekeepers. And as a result, these kind of economic principles end up being important in terms of how these relationships end up being pursued and understood culturally.
And one reason we have such a hard time talking about this is because that argument relies fundamentally, even with all of your very nice, to be sure, caveats, on ladies want relationships, dudes want sex. And if you grant that, then the whole discussion is hashtag problematic for a giant set of, for instance, current college students.
It is. And I think you sort of have to... You have to both table it and interrogate the problematicness of it. Like, you have to be very, very upfront about it at the same time, while also being like, but also it's sort of to the side.
Well, and this is related to campus speech stuff, right? And I now feel like I'm, I don't know what I'm doing, editor-splaining to Robbie. Yeah, I don't know. But similarly in the speech debate, we have now... we've lost language to talk about something in between... I feel physically unsafe and I just don't like it. It's very, very parallel to the sex debate. Robbie, did I get that wrong?
Not at all. And I've found that time and time again, talking to young people and not just activists, although certainly activists, about they use the word safe. Safe is synonymous with comfort. That's how they define safety. It's not just feeling physically safe, but it's feeling like you can walk out of your house and not only will no one, physically hurt you or assault you, but that you will feel affirmed in who you are. You will feel affirmed as a person. That is what it requires to feel safe to a younger person. And that sounds like a bit of a stereotype, but honestly, people have told me that over and over again when I've asked them. So if that's what safety is, I mean, transport that to the realm of sexual politics, of sexual consent. To feel affirmed in your experience is a much higher sort of hurdle to clear to have it end up having been safe and consensual. When we're talking about this on campus, we're talking about encounters that almost always, maybe not almost, in a majority of cases, involve incredible use of alcohol, which clouds judgments or makes you more willing to go along with something, and then you feel differently about it later. Doesn't mean it wasn't consensual unless you were like literally blacked out, but you're liable to do things you wouldn't do otherwise. And there's so much. Drinking. I mean, there's always drinking in this same conversation with the kind of college disputes, which just further complicates.
So I just want to jump in here and suggest that perhaps high quality, precisely measured cocktails are the solution to sexual assault on campus, because if you're drinking like a nicely measured cocktail, sipping it slowly at like, you know, a slow rate rather than, you know, pouring Jack Daniels through a beer, nothing wrong with Jack Daniels used properly and sparingly, through a beer, like a funnel attached to a football helmet or something, right? Like, one is going to sort of make your, enliven your evening a little bit and make it more pleasant, and the other one is going to get you blackout, like, oh my God, what am I doing? What room am I in drunk?
I actually think this is right, I mean, which is why I've written that.
No, the
drinking age has, to my mind, exaggerated this sort of the sexual misconduct problem, because young people, you know, all these college students, most of them are under the age of 21, so they can't drink responsibly in public at a bar, at a nice Peter-facilitated happy hour. They are, you know, the older students are the gatekeepers of alcohol. They go to parties, they drink from the mystery liquid in the trough, they don't know what they're drinking, or they're, you know, shotgunning Fireball before they go out, you know, taking it out of their coat pocket or something. The drinking is not happening kind of in public, in places where authority figures might moderate its use or might help people who take it too far. With they can't drink alongside their professors. You know, the bar has an incentive to not have sexual assault happening in front of its face, but they can't drink at the bar. So this is kind of a very stereotypical libertarian black market effect, or not a libertarian an effect libertarians complain about.
Again, I am obviously being a little facetious, not entirely, but a little facetious about the cocktails thing. But where my whole argument about cocktails is that prohibition, you know, obviously drove it all underground, killed the art of it, and made people drink, you know, sort of rapidly at crap liquor, and they were binge drinking, and it was all sort of associated with all types of criminal activity during prohibition. And then eventually we ended up, you know, decades later with this much more refined drinking culture that was about drinking well rather than drinking too much. Where does prohibition still exist? Where is it still most felt? It is for people under 21 on college campuses. And so once again, we see the same types of, not exactly the same, but we see a similar type of kind of black market prohibition drinking, where drinking is about drinking way too much when you can, and drinking crap.
There's like a stereotype of the, you know, the college student that's like, oh, I should have lived in the 20s. And was that college student me? Maybe. But, you know, it's like, actually, you're living the reality of prohibition, and like your life demonstrates that speakeasies mostly are not glamorous. They're sort of like gross and sneaky, and they're bad booze in them, and then your flapper dress falls off. I don't know. That metaphor fell apart.
I think that speakeasies were most glamorous in places that had the most power. So New York had so much power, cultural power, that it could ignore prohibition, and speakeasies were kind of cool, and famous people would go. And Washington was one big speakeasy, right? They had their own little prohibition guy who would give them all the booze.
The green hat guy.
Peter, you almost came close to convincing me of that. I totally agree with that. The prohibition and the drinking age creates all kinds of just ridiculous pathologies. And now, even more so than, you know, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you have this weird thing where it's like, we go from zero tolerance, safe space. Boom, you're 18. Go have all the sex and drink all the booze all the time, and you're on your own, and you have no idea how to tie your own shoe in public. And that, you know, I think the John Haidt, Lenore Skenazy piece, which still is like the highest traffic thing we've ever done. My God.
Yeah, we're not doing any more articles. That's our article at Reason now. Go read it. The Fragile Generation. Read it again.
It's a good article, folks.
It connects those things in a way that's helpful. I would just say that the way that I disagree with you, Peter, and this could be my own experience talking to some degree, is that when you're young and dumb, you just don't care what shit tastes like. You're playing the Century Club. Like, you don't care. You're not pounding the one shot of beer every minute for 100 straight minutes with an IPA. You just
you're going. I really feel like
dilly dilly.
In fact, Century
the
Club.
The correct
with
response
other
to this
than
should be from Catherine,
hard,
who I believe. I believe I've heard Catherine tell stories about a friend she had in college who basically set up a craft bar in his dorm room.
Yes, those stories are true. His name was Scott McNabb, and he was a hero.
Before we have to excuse Peter out, I want to talk a little bit about National School Choice Week, which is this week. There's going to be a bunch of exciting content at Reason.com and events, too, I hope. Catherine, you've been covering school choice since you were in short pants. Tell us about the week and what we can expect.
Bunch of good school choice week stuff coming up. From the print magazine, we have a feature by Reason Foundation education policy analyst Tyler Koteski, who wrote for us about tiny schools, which is something that is near and dear to my heart. I've been sort of half-assedly trying to start one of these tiny schools for a while. You know, it's the same as the tiny house movement, but schools. And in general, this is, I think, a vision of the future of education that before the modern version of the school choice movement came around, people had trouble getting to, right? There was this sort of schools are gigantic. They are controlled centrally. Even if they were, even if they are private, they're often still, you know, Catholic schools are still the same essential model of, you know, central control with some subsidiarity. And the rise of smaller independent schools and the surprising integration of those smaller independent schools into our public school system through the charter movement, is, in retrospect, a much more, forgive me for this, 21st century way of thinking about these things. People want personalized, they want it close to their home, they want it super responsive, they want it tailored to them. It was not a question ever of finding the one right model for education. It was always a question of breaking it into tiny pieces and letting everybody do their own thing. And School Choice Week content at Reason and around the interwebs and actual meet spaces will celebrate that.
I'd let the record show she winced. She winced when she said meet spaces.
I could have said IRL.
I'm glad you didn't because I still don't know what that means. Robbie, you grew up on Betsy DeVos's ranch, right, in Michigan or something like that. No, right. But like you were aware of the DeVos family and know kind of more about her roots and their activities there. And my impression, and please correct me where I'm going to mischaracterize this, is that this is where she comes from. She comes out of this movement and is applying that to the Department of Education. Or at least has the intention to give us some insight into the nexus, the overlap between Betsy DeVos's school choice background, if that's indeed the way to describe it, and what we might expect from the Department of Ed going forward.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. This was kind of a really main issue for her as just an advocate. Before she became education secretary, her husband, Dick DeVos, ran for governor previously of Michigan and did not win. But she has always they have funded sort of school choice efforts, which is one reason I think her selection to be education secretary was fought by the left and by Democrats almost more desperately than any other nominee than nominees for other positions who I thought one could make a much stronger case like Jeff Sessions, maybe we're gonna be really terrible. Whereas Betsy DeVos was, you know, best known for wanting school choice, which is something that a lot of Democrats actually do support, that a lot of leaders of communities of color actually support. But because the Democrats are so beholden to teachers unions, they fought her like harder than anyone else. Now it's limited, I think, how much good really the federal education department can do on issues of school choice, because it's a local issue, it's a state by state issue. Maybe some grants, some funding can be allocated differently. I don't think we as libertarians would really want, you know, her to run the federal government and come in and say, no, now you have to, we're going to defund all of the public schools and we're going to do this or something. That would not be a good model how to do this. But I think it's helpful to have someone who really knows this issue and is really passionate about it in the kind of topmost education leadership position in the country. And you know, I've been very impressed with what she's done on the Title IX due process college front. So, you know, we'll see what can happen on the school choice front. But I think more than any other kind of Trump cabinet official, the criticisms of her were really unfair and, you know, do not reflect kind of the person that she is and the things that she believes, which I think are pretty good. And many people on the left and in the Democratic Party should actually be able to express some preference for.
Suderman, you have no known children besides a 300-pound dog. Do you look at education policy as like this thing that happens on planet Venus you don't have to pay any attention to at all? Or are you extra super mad because you're funding Catherine's brood?
I look at it as a thing that happened to me. Because I was a person who had to go through public schools, and I went to even, I will say, a pretty good one as public schools go. It was pretty safe. The educational attainment was reasonably good. There were a lot of extracurricular activities that served me quite well. In fact, they were about the only part of the high school in particular that really served me well. But I look back. Part of why I am a libertarian, I think, is because having gone through public school and having been forced to take all of these courses that had no relevance and no interest to me, that were taught badly and indifferently, that were basically about shoveling me through, a system defined by people who didn't care what I was interested in or good at, and like weren't trying to build that system. I mean, every time I look at this and I see the people who are defending the status quo, I think you are defending a broken system that is failing a lot of people. Ultimately, it worked out pretty well for me, but I don't think it does for everyone. And I think we are wasting a huge amount of potential just by defending the status quo public school system in America.
Got to say, I wasn't expecting some backstory there from Suderman, some motivation, or origin story. That's what I meant to say there. I'm trying to speak in a language that he understands. I would just add, in my sense of school choice, and like Peter, I went to public schools my whole life, and my daughters will hopefully go to public schools their whole life, is that we moved to our neighborhood in Brooklyn precisely because of its great public school. And pay just a rent that will make your arms fall clean off out of the shoulder sockets in order to do so. And for me to barely afford that rent so that kids can go to a good school. And the fact that people who don't make enough to pay that rent can't go to a similarly good school is just a blot on the general conscience. But that's all the time we have to blot here for. Whoa, I heard some breaking in there.
Oh,
Suderman?
No, this was Robbie. I was Swabby. Just going to add to that when I talk to young people about this issue, I think they are particularly, I think they are in favor of the school choice cause to the degree that they hate arbitrary boundaries and borders. They think it's weird that you would have to go to the school that's just like geographically located in your same area. Like, why does it have to be that way? So I think that's like the best argument to make to young people for why we need this broad school choice reform agenda.
Robbie, thank you especially for joining in and this week and taking our abuse. Nice work, and go out and fix the old hair. Reminder to everyone here, subscribe to us on iTunes, write a little review, talk about how great Robbie was and whatnot, and rate us as well there. And then stay tuned for the rest of the week as we do cool Reason podcasty stuff in general. And then this constellation will be back at you, or some variation thereof, next Monday as well. Goodbye.